You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Last week's killing of George Floyd by a white police officer in Minneapolis made clear that policing needs to change. Just a few years earlier, in 2015, the city had participated in a multi-million dollar, multi-year partnership between academics and law enforcement. It provided anti-bias training, better data collection, and surveying of both police and community members. But George Floyd still died as a police officer kneeled on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Now, there have been calls to decrease funding for the police, including from the National Black Lives Matter movement. In a statement, the group called the death of George Floyd a, quote, breaking point. To discuss this and strategies for better police training, I spoke with Michael Schlosser yesterday. He's director of the Police Training Institute at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I was also joined by Miltonette Craig, a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice Sciences at Illinois State University. One of her primary research areas is police community relations. She's also lectured on education programs in federal prisons, social structure in crime, and individual rights during a search. As a reminder, we invite you to join our conversation on Twitter at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. I started by asking Professor Craig about her initial reaction to hearing about George Floyd's death.
It was a visceral reaction and also numbing at the same time, because this isn't the first time that we have seen this type of footage. And I remember the blood draining out of my face the first time that I watched the killing of Alton Sterling in Louisiana. And it brought back those similar feelings, but even more so because the interaction and use of force took so long. And there were so many pleads for assistance, not only from George himself, but from bystanders and the what appeared to be callous disregard for human life really, you know, just sunk in and, you know, made me cry.
Mike, I want to ask you the same question I began asking Professor Craig. What was your initial reaction when you saw the images and heard what happened to George Floyd?
Well, I'll tell you what, when I saw that video and I saw what was happening to Mr. Floyd, it just, you know, being a compassionate person, it was gut-wrenching. I felt so many ranges of emotion, and all I could think of is, you know, here is a human being laying on the ground. What is this officer doing? I mean, it's just, it was such a sad outrage, and it's like, why aren't police officers standing around saying, you know, get your leg off his neck? Why didn't they pull him off his neck? This is a human being, and just listening to a human being struggling at the end of his life is so difficult for anyone. And it was really a sad, and I'll be honest with you, it made me angry. It made me embarrassed for police work. It's not what we train. I know it's much more complicated than training. I get that. But I just want to say that, you know, my deepest sympathy and condolences go out to the family of George Floyd. It was just something that I can't go a day without picturing that in my mind and not feeling heartbreak for the family.
You know, in what ways did the now former police officer violate protocol for a situation like that? And what do you teach your cadets about how to handle that sort of situation? What should have happened?
Yeah. First of all, he violated humanity. He violated, you know, compassion. He violated what people should be like, not just police officers. And when you look at the tactics are not what's taught in any control tactics system that I have studied. And I've been involved in control tactics and use of force for probably 25 years or more and have taught it. And when I looked at that, just to give you an idea of the normal tactics for a prone subject, if I have a high risk arrest and I may have to prone somebody out, I may have to get onto their back to get control and cuff them. And when you do that, your shins go, depending on which control tactic system, they either go across the shoulder or across the back. You have weight on the balls of your feet. You have some weight on the arrestee. If the arrestee started to become more violent, you can increase that weight on with your shins on them if you need to. But the first thing you do is you get that control and it's safe and you get the handcuffs on. As soon as the handcuffs on, my recruits, in fact, I had my recruits right after this coming up to me and saying, Dr. Schlosser, he said, what was this guy thinking? You're supposed to have the shins across the back. And as soon as you cuff them, the first thing you say to them is, sir, are you okay? Can you breathe? And if there's any sign of distress, and you're even if you're not 100% certain there's distress, you immediately call for medical help. Once they are cuffed, you get them off of their stomach. You have a process. You pull them to their side. You sit them up. You get them to their knees, and you stand them up. You don't just pick them up. There are tactics that you teach, and you can still maintain control of them. And keep in mind, this person was handcuffed. How much of a threat can they be? And you had the principle of mass, which means we had, you know, a greater number of officers to the arrestee. This was quite disgusting, and I'm very outraged by it. And I just can't say that enough.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. That is Mike Schlosser. He's director of the Police Training Institute at the University of Illinois. We're also speaking with Professor Milton Nett Craig, who's in the Department of Criminal Justice Studies at Illinois State University. And Professor Craig, I wonder, what do you think when you hear that description? I mean, you study interactions of police with citizens. What strikes you about that description of the use of force in this case?
The most refreshing thing out of this horrible event is the acknowledgement from many police trainers like Mike and officers and other administrators explaining that the procedure was completely wrong. And even in the exercise to give someone the benefit of the doubt, which I don't think is deserved here, but just as a matter of discussion, once you realize that what you're doing isn't within protocol, you have the opportunity to change course. And especially as Mike said, and as we've seen in the reports, this wasn't a 30-second interaction. And so again, beyond disturbing, saddening, disappointing, and especially when proper training we believe is received is then ignored, that not only, of course, is a risk to human life, but also to the legitimacy of the policing institution as a whole, right? If we don't see officers following rules, then how can we be confident in them protecting and serving us as a community?
Professor Craig, I'd like to turn to the protests now. And I wonder, what do you think police departments should keep in mind during these demonstrations and how they respond to the people doing the protesting?
Well, I've seen a few different responses. And so I know one that I had in mind was the apparent solidarity that some officers who are placed at these gatherings engage in, such as kneeling with demonstrators. When I attended the local gathering here in Bloomington Normal, one of my colleagues in the department said that when she continued on, that there were Illinois State Patrol officers who were raising their fists to show unity in message. And I think it's good on its face. However, there needs to be more behind that, right? It's not enough to appear as if you are in support. You have to show it. And so, an important thing that agencies should keep in mind when it comes to these protests are basically demonstrators' perceptions, right? So if a peaceful gathering is set to begin, there is no reason to have 100 officers in riot gear and military tanks show up immediately at the scene. Doing so sends the message that police-citizen relationships will continue to be adversarial, even while citizens are pleading for respect and dignity in the way that they are being treated. And so, yes, of course, departments can and probably should have officers at or close to demonstration venues in the event that things get out of hand and need to be de-escalated. But the primary approach should be civility and the presumption of nonviolence so that demonstrators can freely air their grievances and express their shared sadness about the pervasiveness of police brutality. I did also want to say, and as we chatted a little bit earlier about the shift in what the demonstrations can look like from the original intention. So I wish, of course, especially with the media, that they would make that distinction between those who are there legitimately to protest against ongoing brutality and violence and mistreatment on the part of police, and those who show up simply as agitators, whether their motives are some kind of political statement or just plain old recklessness. They're two distinct groups. And so I don't think that everything should be lumped into one category. And I especially take issue with, framing that says that this is, a riot and this is devolving into chaos. When that's not the initial attention. So just that clarification that here's why we came here and here's what the differently intentioned individuals turned this event into. That just needs to be clarified.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Professor Milton Nett Craig in the Department of Criminal Justice Sciences at Illinois State University, and Mike Schlosser, who's director of the Police Training Institute at the University of Illinois. Mike, in the past, you've been on the show talking about the concept of policing with empathy. Can you, and as we just heard Professor Craig say, there are some officers and sheriffs and police chiefs out there who've been meeting with protesters, taking a knee with them, raising their fist, as we just heard. Can you talk a little bit about, those acts of seeming solidarity and also this concept of policing with empathy?
The policing with empathy and respect is something that it's not just a class. We have them for 14 weeks, and we want people, we want officers to be empathetic and understanding towards others, especially those that are different from them. We want them to have true empathy. And so I have brought in several programs that go beyond what the state requires, because I think, if we get to know people as people and they get to know police as people, we get to know each other, I think we'll find out there's a lot more commonalities and maybe understanding why someone thinks a certain way about police and maybe, a little bit about them and their lives and how they grew up and how we grew up, and we learned to get to know each other. We could have a little more empathy towards each other. Some of the programs that I started, I worked with a couple of professors here on campus. We created a program called Policing in a Multiracial Society. And this is a class that is 9 hours beyond what's required by the state. Things like you have to cover implicit bias, you have to cover this, you have to cover cultural competencies. But working with these professors, we have created an additional 9 hours. We do have to make it an optional course because it's beyond the state mandates. But the idea is to try to increase the officer's awareness of their own, social identities and their own racial beliefs. We all have attitudes, assumptions, and biases, and it doesn't make us bad people, but we need to learn. We need to first own it. We need to acknowledge it. We need to understand it. We also want to increase their knowledge about, theory of research related to the intersection of police and race. And, that includes things like implicit bias, colorblind racial ideology, what are microaggressions, what is institutional racism, experiences of racial minority with police, and so on. And then we want to develop the officer's efficacy to apply skills that we teach. And a big part of what we teach, beyond this, is we teach de-escalation training. We just want them to understand that the criminal justice system is far beyond perfect, and that they are the future of policing. They're the future, detectives and chiefs and sheriffs, and they can make a difference in the future, but we have to understand more than just, we are police, we do the right thing, it's an honorable career, and we go out there and do our job, and it's a tough job, and we really emphasize, don't get into the us against them mentality. Get rid of that blue coat of silence and do the right thing and make us proud of this profession. And we have a long ways to go, but we're not going to give up.
I mean, I wonder, do you see people coming into your program with those thin blue line shirts that are so common among police officers and people who, you know, say they support the police? Is that, or is that something you actively try to work against?
Yeah, I do see some people with the thin blue line, and the, maybe they have a t-shirt or something like that. And I'm not totally sure that everyone understands what that truly means. It's just almost like a, you know, we're the police and there's this thin blue line, and do they really understand that, you know, it's not just we are the people that are holding the good against the bad, and we are, you know, it's you know, we're more community policing oriented, and you know, plus we're not like a boot camp, and I think there's so many academies that are boot camp like, and by that I mean they're, you know, up and yelling in their face and treating them, you know, as if they're in the military, and that adds to the, you know, militaristic ideology of policing. We base things on the adult learning model. We treat all of our recruits with respect, just like we want them to treat people on the street with respect. So we do things a lot different, I think, than other police academies. So the goal is to do the best we can, knowing that some will go back to their department, and some departments will have a great culture, and they'll go back to some departments and some shifts on some departments that have a different culture, and they may fall into that culture. We can't stay with them throughout their careers, but we are planting a seed, at least I hope, and giving them hope that, you know, because the young people we get here, it's like, I why did I choose this job? I want to help people that can't help themselves. I want to protect people. I want to be part of the community. I want to be a mentor to the youth. And so, you know, we're really pushing for police reform in so many ways, and, you know, not as far as how, you know, a department might have police reform or be forced to police reform based on a consent decree, but we, you know, do what we can at the academy level to help reform policing.
Coming up after the break, we'll continue our conversation with more from our guests about effective policing strategies and get their reactions on calls to defund the police in light of George Floyd's killing while in police custody in Minneapolis. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, my guests today are Michael Schlosser, director of the Police Training Institute at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and Miltonette Craig, a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice Sciences at Illinois State University. We've been speaking with them about law enforcement training and strategies in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. I spoke with both of them yesterday afternoon, and in this second half of our conversation, you'll hear more about calls to defund the police and what they think more effective policing strategies might look like. As ever, let us know what you think by tweeting us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. Now, this is a situation where the police were, I believe, called for allegedly some sort of, I think it was a counterfeit bill or something like that. In other cases, it's been about loose cigarettes or, you know, some sort of minor vehicle violation. And I understand, have written about the sort of counterproductivity of this order maintenance policing. I think in other contexts, some people call it broken windows policing. And I wonder if you can talk about that and maybe, you know, counter that with what are, in your view, are some effective policing strategies.
Sure. So yes, order maintenance, policing is also known, as you said, as broken windows, and some departments refer to it as quality of life policing. And so just for a little background, those types of tactics are largely based on the work of a couple of scholars, James Wilson and George Kelling, when they published an article in the Atlantic in the early 1980s. And so they discussed a theory that basically says that if agencies police minor disorder, it will prevent more serious crime. So the rationale there is that urban decay and blight signals that there's no social control, whether formal or informal, and that it's okay to not just do small things, but to escalate to large things. And so that's why we hear when departments employ these tactics, they will go after things like littering and loitering and panhandling, tagging, turnstile jumping, and things of that nature. And so although the rationale may have been well-intentioned, of course, the effects of it in practice have been beyond disappointing in terms of police community relations, because first, there's this hyper focus on behavior that everyone would agree is not that important. And then those types of tactics are then deployed in areas that are most likely to have already been disadvantaged. And so it's just further alienating members of those communities. And so, in my opinion, rather than arresting individuals for those kinds of low-level offenses, and of course we know that then creates a damaging criminal record that's going to affect these people later on, the strategies that should be used involve direct positive contact with community members. I believe that agencies should know who their residents are and should speak to them regularly about what they need from officers in order to feel safe in their neighborhoods and to feel proud, right? We want people to take pride in their neighborhoods because then it can assist with the prevention of urban decay and blight and things of that nature. But you also need to approach these residents with the idea that protect and serve is at the top of the list, as opposed to stop and frisk.
Professor Craig, as I scroll through social media in the past week or so, I've been seeing a lot more talk about this idea of defunding the police, you know, and using that money to go instead towards things like domestic violence prevention, housing, mental health intervention. I wonder, what do you think about calls to decrease funding for local police departments after the killing of George Floyd?
I was actually pleasantly surprised by the calls. I didn't think that people would have gone to a part of the root of the problem so quickly. So I was happy to hear it. And I think why that decision is not only unique, but important and effective, because it reinforces the fact that following the rules are important. And so if those tasked with protecting the community aren't following the rules, then that behavior should not be reinforced by continued financial support, which of course enables the continuation of that unwanted behavior. And so, yes, if we see that funds are being used to encourage these kinds of breaks in protocol or to give bonuses to problematic officers, then I think, yes, it is acceptable. As I read in the news recently that the Minneapolis School District said that it no longer wants to contract with the city's police department to provide school resource officers. So it's to show that if you're not going to use the funds in order to protect and serve, then we need to place these towards other areas that will help make this community a better place. And so again, it's that positive reinforcement idea that I think is important and useful.
Mike, what about you? What do you think about these calls to defund the police?
Yeah, I completely understand and empathize with that idea, but at the same time, I think that in some ways, officers or departments, if they're doing things the right way, obviously, but I think some departments actually are underfunded in the fact that for the policing reforms that I have in mind would actually require more funds. Here's what I want more funds for. I want more funds for continued training. Departments do not get enough training, and they need to get training, but they need the right kind of training. You know, they need the training on cultural competency. They need the training on, you know, empathy and respect, and they need the training on proper tactics. And the one thing that I can have the recruits help policing at the ground level requires more police. And let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. So, you know, I talk about how I policed, you know, during my career. And I was able to get out of my car, get out of my squad car, and make non-enforcement contacts all the time. I got to know people in my community as people. They got to know me. I was called Officer Mike. Hey, Officer Mike, how's it going? We talk about anything. We might talk about my, you know, my Bulls, my Cubs, my Bears, music, what's going on in the community, you know, my family, their family, playing catch with the kids, talking, just we, and then they got to know me as a person, and they're realizing, hey, this is Officer Mike. He's got kids. I see him at the youth center in uniform and out of uniform with his kids, and develop that relationship. And if officers could just spend more time, you know, sometimes officers have a tendency to just sort of be isolated in their vehicles, and they only get out to handle calls. There's a lot of great officers that are out there, you know, making community efforts. There really are. But sometimes if you're shorthanded, and especially in the summer, the reality is officers might be just going from call to call to call and then writing reports, and they don't have the time. But that being said, I don't want community policing officers, meaning I have five officers on my department that are community policing officers. They're going out and doing the talks. They're going out and shaking hands and talking to people and getting to know people. Every single patrol officer, probably even sergeant, lieutenant, and up, should be a community policing officer. So I want funding for training, the right kind of training. I want funding so officers have the time to get out and get to know their community. And, you know, that's kind of my, you know, my idea on that.
Professor Craig, as we hear this talk about reforms, and I think in Minneapolis, I've read that they brought in an implicit bias trainer, and they were going to use data collection and social psychology and have these dialogues between police and the communities. And yet here we are today. I wonder, what do you think should be done? What has been done that hasn't worked in the past, and what sort of changes would you like to see in the way police departments operate?
So I do agree with Mike in this, as I mentioned before, the need to substantively and empathetically engage with the community. So just for example, we saw recently in news coverage that both Chief Arredondo in Minneapolis and Chief Shields in Atlanta actually went directly into demonstrations and respectfully engaged with the citizens who were protesting. And so, of course, that is signaling that even top brass is open to giving citizens' concerns proper and timely attention. But yes, training is important. And we've been talking about the need for the increase in training and the different information conveyed in that training. But just like you said, these calls have gone on for decades, and these trainings occur regularly in many departments, and we still do not see the equity in treatment in many of these areas. So I don't think it's just about training. There has to be some other delivery of the information, because in many of these areas where the training does not appear to be effective, it could be just because, all right, you're required to take this class, sit through it, take the quiz, and then go on about your business. And so it more needs the kind of, not just training, but uprooting the problematic behavior, right? So even if we do have someone who is more progressive, who is more empathetic at the top of the police hierarchy, if the bad seeds, quote unquote, are not found and, you know, kicked out, basically, then how do we have this large scale change that actually is going to help the community? Because just because someone sits in training doesn't mean that they are digesting and accepting the information that is being presented to them.
Yeah, can I say something on that?
Please do.
Yeah, I think that the type of training, the quality of training, I think that is still under development. It still requires more research. We don't know exactly what works, and so it makes it difficult. And whereas many departments take this training seriously, and officers do too, Yes, if there's certain mandates out there that you have to have implicit bias training, or you have to have training on non-normative behavior and developmental disabilities and this thing, you know, it's required. So do some departments say, okay, you can go to this training that covers that mandate, and I've checked it off my list, but is it really doing any good? So it's the quality, it's the type of training, it's the, you know, it's from the academy, it's from the leadership of the department, it's changing police culture, it's very complicated. And it's not just complicated because of the police culture, it's complicated because we live in a world that was created by racism, and racism still exists today. However, it may look different, it may be more subtle in so many ways. This racism still exists, and we're kidding ourselves if we say it doesn't.
Mike Schlosser is director of the University of Illinois Police Training Institute. Professor Milton Nett Craig is in the Department of Criminal Justice Sciences at Illinois State University. Thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, sir.
That's all the time we have for today, but before we go, I just want to remind our listeners that as we continue to cover developing stories like this one, you can help us shape our news coverage. Join our Text the 21st initiative. Just text the word TALK to 217-803-0730 to join our new texting initiative. Again, the word is TALK to 217-803-0730. We'll be in touch. We'll have information about that on our Twitter page. You can follow us there at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. We always tweet out links with more analysis and background about what we've been talking about during the show. On Facebook, just search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post your own questions or comments you want us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, and information about that texting group is on our website, 21stshow.org. We've got all of our past shows there. You can also find us most places you get your podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Our show is produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Ryan Wild. Our intern is Zaini Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Bork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.